Okay, the first speaker today is Paul Aigré, Director de Recherche, Institut Jean Nicot. And the title of the talk is Two Kinds of Partial Truth.
Paul. All right. Is it okay with you if I take off the mask? Okay, I had my booster shot a few days ago, so I hope that it minimizes the risk. Well, first of all, I would like to thank Jean-Baptiste Rosy and François Recanati for hosting this workshop. I'd like to thank the organizing committee and most of all, Steve Yablo, who made all the travel with Sally. It's wonderful, wonderfully generous. I'm actually going to talk about the notion of partial truth. The talk is titled Two Kinds of Partial Truth. I'm not sure I'll have the time to go over all the material in my talk. And in a way, I feel I have mixed feelings because on the one hand, I think I might say too much and I might also say too little, depending on the parts. So this is a still inchoate idea. Let me try to move on. Okay, so here is Yablo's definition of partial truth, which I recognize from the book, Aboutness. A hypothesis is partly true, if and only if it has parts that are wholly true. And you see, of course, the definiendum on the left-hand side of the if and only if, and then these two notions of having parts and being wholly true. The main argument that I'd like to explore in the paper is the following. So Yablo's definition of partial truth implies the notion of being wholly true. And I'm wondering whether there could be cases of partial truth of which no part is wholly true. I'd like to call the corresponding notion an intensive notion of partial truth. And the question is the intensive notion coherent, well-motivated? Is it reducible to the extensive notion? And right away, I want to sort of give you the sort of analogy that I have in mind. Just change true for blue, so another adjective, right? And what could partly blue mean if you're talking about a rectangle? Well, it could mean that it has some part that is wholly blue. But I take it could also mean, and that's more controversial, all of whose parts are somewhat blue. So if I show you this picture, you'll recognize on screen that it's a partly blue rectangle. And it has a blue part and it has a green part. I'm not sure that this will display very well, but I tried to pick a homogeneous rectangle where the variety of color hue selected is supposed to be uncertain or borderline between a green shade and a blue shade. So, well, of course, some of you might call this teal blue, or some of you might not see this as blue, but recognize that other people see this as blue, and so on and so forth. But you see, there's this difference between having a blue, this notion of extent and this notion of degree, sort of associated with the two pictures. And there certainly is a correspondence between the two notions. But let's see where this analogy can take us. So as I said, first thing says some part is not blue, and the second says, well, somewhat blue. So the basic issue is whether it makes sense to distinguish partly true in the sense intended by Yablo in the book, and let's say somewhat true, which you may want also to paraphrase as true-ish, and whether these notions always mean the same thing. So I'm gonna first talk about the question I was asking, I was posing first, because I want to clarify also the strategy followed by Yablo in aboutness, talk about partial truth, asking whether a statement could be true without having true parts, and then I'll focus on a certain category of partial truth, which I like to call half-truths, and then discuss, if there's time, in what sense truth could be gradable, could really be a gradable notion. So here's a paradigmatic case of partial truth. Take this conjunctive sentence, London is in England and Paris is in Spain. You recognize the first conjunct to be true, the second to be false. So the conjunction has a true conjunct, it is partly true. And notice that its conjunct is either clearly true or clearly false, right? There's no issue about that. So first question, which I think on which there might be some misunderstanding, is when I ask, could a sentence be true or partly true without any true or wholly true part? We need to clarify what is the part of a statement or a part of a sentence. And depending on which approach you take, whether a syntactic or a semantic notion of parthood, you get different answers to the question of whether a sentence can be true without having true parts. So just to make it very clear, if you take a full sentence, like London is not in Spain, a true sentence, thereby the negation of a false sentence, sentence is true, because it's fully true in this case, you may say, well, it's partly true. No proper syntactic part of the sentence, so the sub-sentence, London is in Spain, is not true, but we're not going to use that as an argument that although the sentence is true, it has no true part, right? Since, in fact, we're really concerned about the content of the sentence, the proposition it expresses, and that is true. And this is what is reflected in Yablo's book by distinguishing content from sentences and propositions expressed from sentences. There may be more tricky cases, though, like if London is in Spain, then Paris is in England. I'm not entirely sure what the parts of a conditional sentence should be. But there's obviously one analysis of conditional sentences, the two material conditional analysis, the two-valued material conditional analysis on which the sentence is true. You could say, well, if the parts are the antecedent consequent in this case, the sentence would be true on the material conditional analysis, although it has no true parts. But again, it would be making the same mistake because you could deny that the relevant parts are just these syntactic parts. Just say that a negation, namely the proposition expressed by the negation of the antecedent, is a relevant semantic part, for instance, and then you avoid any problems. However, you could also reject the horseshoe analysis of the conditional and agree that the sentence in this case is indeterminate, and it's captured by some trivalent accounts of conditionals mentioned by Yablo in the book, investigated by various people, including Dan Rothschild here, the so-called Definetti conditional, also known as Belknap's conditional, and so on and so forth. In that case, the sentence would not even be partly true, it would just be indeterminate, and so the problem is gone. But let's look at the third problem, so disjunctions, so which are logical truth in classical logic, but here built on parts, syntactic parts, that, let's say, on a certain analysis would not be wholly true. In a sense, we need to clarify. So either Pluto is a planet or Pluto is not a planet, admitting that Pluto is a borderline case of being a planet. So on a supervaluationist analysis of the vagueness of planet, the sentence is such that no disjunct is super true, because you could precisify planet in a way that makes the first disjunct true but also false, and conversely. But the disjunction is wholly true in the sense of super true. So although no part of the sentence is wholly true, so now, again, we stick to the idea that the parts would be the disjuncts in this case. And this problem would be averted as follows, as I understand in Jabla's analysis, because there's a much more elaborate notion of the notion of content parthood, where now content A includes content B as a part if A entails B, and every truth maker for A contains a truth maker for B, and every false maker for B is a false maker for A. So if you take this A or not A sentence, we have to say neither A nor not A is included in the content of the disjunction as a part, since neither of the disjuncts is entailed. And the disjunction then is still partly true because true is impliciter and it has itself as a part, and problem is solved. However, I want to zoom in on the sort of clarification or elaboration given by Steve in the appendix to Boughtonness, where it is written that a directed content A, which is a proposition and subject matter, is partly true if and only if it has a non-trivial true part. So I'm highlighting this non-trivial clause just because I wasn't sure whether that non-trivial, this is something certainly you'll clarify in the discussion, qualifies true or qualifies the parthood relation. If it qualifies truth, it would mean, well, that there's room for being contingently true. Otherwise, it would be being a proper part. And I take it means the latter and not the former. But now take an atomic sentence. So with no, by definition, it has no proper sentential part. You could pick Pluto is a planet, if you like. Or, so I'm asking, is there still a legitimate sense in which the sentence can be partially true without being wholly true? Because, of course, since the definition we had here of content inclusion is reflexive, if you're fully true, you're partly true, but the question is still there, right? Whether the content of the sentence can be partially true without the sentence being wholly true. So we still need to distinguish then the two notions. And so to answer the question, I want to flesh out this distinction between what I suggest is a distinction between extensive partial truths and intensive partial truths. And I propose to look more closely at cases of what I call half-truth, but what we call half-truth in many contexts. So a half-truth can be defined as a sentence that it has, I think the notion has several pre-theoretic or common uses or definitions, implicit definitions. Sometimes a sentence that a statement that fails to tell the whole truth in violation of Grice's maxim of quantity, or a sentence that is true in one relevant sense but false in another, and this time in violation of Grice's maxim of quality. Both failures, note, can co-occur, and both are related to some connection between utterances and information queries. Here is an example I revisited in the light of Steve's book. You may remember we had a French minister of budget who was convicted of fraud with his own tax declarations. And he had made the sentence, I do not have, Mr. Deputy, I never had a foreign bank account, neither now nor before. I used to present this as a paradigmatic example of a falsehood, until reading Steve's book, I realized that there's this clever intertwining of truth and falsity in the sentence. So if you split up the sentence, "I do not have a foreign bank account now," I take it that was true when he said it. But "I never had a foreign bank account before" was false. So the sentence is determinately false. It has a true part. That's certainly technically a half truth, although we would not take, you know, count it as a half truth, because in this case the falsity just prevails. So that's certainly not a good example of what we ordinarily call a half truth. But I'll return to that. It's a half truth in the extensive sense I was trying to distinguish from the more intensive sense. So now take another example, which is discussed by Augustine and also by Andreas Stocke in his book on lying and sincerity. So you may have read in the Bible, in Genesis, you may remember the case where Abraham is asked by King Abimelech whether Sarah is his wife. And the answer is, "Sarah is my sister." It is actually true, because Sarah is Abraham's father's daughter. She's not his mother's daughter, right? It's not an incestuous marriage. But it's also false, because Sarah is not just his sister, she's also his wife, which I think was the question asked by King Abimelech. So there's at least two analyses of the case, right? One in which seven is a fully true sentence with a false implicature. And then there's this analysis on which the sentence is really half true, because it's amphibolous. It's true in one sense of sister, but it's false in another sense. There are more cases like that I want to mention with present day kings, right? Like you may remember this sentence by Bill Clinton, "I've never had sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky." And he was asked, "Well, if she told someone she had an affair with you, would that be a lie?" And interestingly, he said, "It's certainly not the truth. It would not be the truth." So if you look more closely at the case, note that he doesn't say it's false. He prefers to say it's not true, because it only implicates that the claim is false. But there's this interpretation in which the claim actually contains a grain of truth, but it's not the whole truth. In fact, if you remember Clinton's defense strategy, I vaguely remember it. I was in the States back then. Even David Lewis had interest for that example. I think, Gideon, you remember. So there's this precisification of the expression "sexual affairs or relations" on which the claim is false. But there's one in which it's true. And I when he was asked, "Have you ever had sexual relations with Miss Monica Lewinsky, as that term is defined in Deposition Exhibit 1, he said, "No, in good faith, I thought the definition included," and then comes a long definition, which was the judge's attempt to precisify the term. But he could say, "Well, given how you precisify the term, I can actually say sincerely in the sense of truthfully, that this was not the case." And there's an interesting literature on this, I should say, in the legal case. Okay, so now I return to other cases. In aboutness, there's a discussion of loose talk, and there's a discussion of cases of sentences which can be taken both ways. So one of the examples is Yavlo's ice cream case. In this dialogue between Zina and Steve, Zina says, "You never take me out for ice cream anymore." And Steve says, "I just took you out for ice cream on your birthday." So 12 has this literal meaning. I'm assuming the context for any more, right? There's also some wiggle room there, but it's let's assume this disagreement on a certain moment in time. So never would mean never at all, in which case it's false, and Steve is right. But it also has this intended meaning, like almost never, which makes it true. So this brings me to this generalization we can make on these cases, that we may call a half-truth in the extensive sense an unequivocal sentence, some of whose content parts is true. And if you want to insist that it's really half and not fully, you could say, well, and some of which is false, right? But now a half-truth intensively may be defined as an equivocal sentence, some interpretation of which is relevantly true and another relevantly false. So the Cahuzac case is technically an extensive half-truth. The Abraham case and the other cases, I take it, are of the latter kind. And what I call equivocal sentence, by the way, it includes vague, not just amphibolous sentences, but also vague sentences, I think, more generally. So when thinking about these cases, I had in mind also the setting of the framework that I've been working in with some of my co-authors, Pablo Cobreras, Dave Ripley, and Robert Van Roy. But it relates to work by Sam Alkhatib and Jeff Pelletier and Dominic Hyde, distinguishing two notions of truth. So this idea that a sentence is strictly true if it's true in all its relevant interpretations, which you could call super true also, and a sentence is tolerantly true if it's true in some of its relevant interpretations, and Hyde would call it sub-true. Now, let's go back to the examples. So this one really has the structure of the Cahuzac sentence. Paris is in Spain and London is in England. It's partly true in the extensive sense, but it's not tolerantly true. There's no way for the sentence to be tolerantly true. So there you get this dissociation between being partly true and being tolerantly true. On the other hand, "You never take me out for ice cream anymore." That's partly true. Also in the extensive sense, depending, I think, on your analysis of a word like never, but I think there's an analysis on which it is also partly true in this extensive sense, and it is tolerantly true. So in that case, you get both. And we can look back to the figures I was mentioning, like cases of loose talk. My initial description of this figure was this: the rectangle is partly blue, but we know that we can say also in situations like that the rectangle is blue. It can be asserted tolerantly because a sufficiently large part of the rectangle is blue, corresponding to these cases of non-maximal readings that have been discussed by Lazarsan, Burnett, Christian Spector, Feynman. It's an I, not a Y. I'll correct that. And in the case 17, you could also say the rectangle is blue without qualifying. It can be asserted tolerantly because it's true on some interpretations of blue, sufficiently close to the set of focal interpretations. So the way we cashed out this distinction in previous work initially was the idea that all lexically vague predicates can be used in two senses, a stronger and a weaker. That was the idea. If you take a predicate P, it can be interpreted relative to a usual classical structure, except that on top of it you had a similarity relations for predicates. These similarity relations can be reflexive and symmetric, can refer to be transitive for cases of vagueness. Now, for an object A to be P tolerantly, is that is tolerantly true if there is an object B sufficiently similar to A such that B is P is classically true. And for the strict definition, you just get the dual universal quantification over the object similar to the given object. If you like to think of this in terms of, you know, super and sub-truth, that's entirely possible. But that was the TCS picture, and of course that lines up with a number of other accounts of vagueness. Borderline cases, classical logic needs to adjudicate them, like for Toll, with a sharp line, but in the strict way of viewing the predicates, there is a region of underlap represented in black here, and in the case of the tolerant, there's this region of overlap. Okay, so how much time do I have left, Jean-Baptiste, for at this point?
20 minutes.
Okay, thanks. So let's take stock. So a sentence can be partly true, whether extensively or intensively. But if so, one may ask whether truth isn't gradable after all, which is a sort of a broader point I want to make. Of course, there's a whole literature on whether truth is a grading notion ever since, you know, the early days of fuzzy logic. The idea was quite starkly criticized by Susan Hack in some of her papers, whether true is gradable. And her position was truth does not come in degrees. In two recent papers, Jared Anderson and I have claim that it, actually truth is gradable, although in a limited way, sufficient to sustain the strict tolerant distinction I was making. Well, gradable adjectives are defined by these features that they support comparative morphology and also intensive modification by very. So in the case of tall, you could say tall, very tall, taller. For true, arguably, at least in English and French, you can say true, truer, very true. So people have distinguished three kinds of adjectives. The non-scalar ones, like pregnant, prime, hexagonal, which do not pass these tests easily, at least. And then relative gradable adjectives, like tall, short, rich, and poor. And absolute adjectives, like flat, bumpy, safe, dangerous, clear, and clear, are called absolute gradable adjectives. And they sort of fall in between the non-scalar and the relative adjectives. So in which of these three classes does true fall? I think it's a difficult question because, in fact, you could assign, there are arguments to assign true to any of these three classes in the literature. I think fuzzy logicians were very happy, and that's what I think Hack rightfully criticized, that this shouldn't be in this class. I completely agree with her that it should not be there, but should it be here or should it be there? And when I read Yablo's account of partial truth, I was thinking, well, it's the account is completely consistent with a view on which, let's call it a conservative view, on which true is not gradable. It's a on or off notion. However, I think there are arguments to think that true is an absolute gradable adjective. So you need, if you think so, you need to defeat an objection, which is that even non-scalar adjectives can sometimes support comparative or intensified constructions. You could say Mary is even more pregnant than Sue to mean that she's very pregnant. which means that she's a state or more visible pregnancy, and the notion of coerced means something else. However, I think a response to this is that, so you could say the same thing about true, that the gradable notion of true is just only a coarse notion of true to mean true and some other property, maybe clear true, clear truth, or... However, you can also, again, rely to these adverbial modifiers to some extent or not completely. I think it's not good to say this number is prime to some extent. This number is not completely prime. Mary's pregnant to some extent, even in the coarse case. I mean, it sort of cancels the coarse meaning. She's not completely pregnant. I'm not sure that what it means, but to say that Anna Turns is true to some extent or not completely true, I think it's completely admissible. So that's a test to suggest that true isn't non-scalar, and that these completely and to some extent really pick on the non-modified notion of truth. I want to make a further distinction, which is that if you zoom in on these typologies of gradable adjectives, various theorists have distinguished within the class of absolute adjectives of two classes, total and partial adjectives. So Cruz and Yuan distinguish so-called partial adjectives like dirty, which could mean has some degree of, I guess, not dirt, but let's say dirtiness, let's put it this way. It doesn't mean that it has no degree of cleanliness, and clean could also mean like it has no degree of dirt or dirtiness. It doesn't mean that it has some degree of cleanliness. So clean is a total adjective, dirty is a partial adjective. So there you see the distinction I was making, right? You have non-scalar adjectives like prime, composite, relative gradable adjectives like tall, short, absolute ones like safe, dangerous. That's a total partial pair. But then things like full, empty, that's a total pair. How you distinguish between them with this test, the completely slightly test, there is a Diego Feynman, right, correctly spelled, sorry Diego. Slightly, completely can be used to modify, let's say, completely safe, but completely dangerous is odd. This is slightly safe is odd, but slightly dangerous is fine. This is completely true. This is completely false. You can say both. So it would suggest that it's a total pair. However, I looked into whether saying that statements are slightly true or slightly false is so bad. And I didn't find the same sort of evidence that it was, you know, equally bad as the other cases you have in 27. Here is an example. Take the sentence, I always attend class. It was a survey found online. Answer the following questions using a scale from 1 to 5. Completely true of me. Very true of me. Moderately true of me. Slightly true. Not at all true. Here you'll go above, beyond, and farther. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. I should have maybe. No, there's no absolutely no intention to disparage the because I think this makes complete sense, right? We can definitely answer these questions. So maybe that's a marginal use, but not unattested. And in fact, the best argument that was given to me was by Jérémy Zer, showing that some adjectives accept both kinds of modifiers, like opaque. You could say this is slightly opaque, but also this is completely opaque, or this is slightly transparent, or this is completely transparent. And the argument there is that I think true and false really pattern as these ambiguous pairs. They can pattern like a total partial pair or like a total pair. So that's the sort of ST picture viewed in terms of degrees. Suppose you have a minimum degree for truth and falsity and a maximum degree. So to be if something is strictly false, it would like be represented by the minimum extent on that scale. But if it's strictly true, it would pick the endpoint, the opposite polar endpoint. But I take it that false tolerantly could just mean the exclusion of what we mean when we say, well, it's not perfectly true, in other words, but if you could also be true tolerantly if you're not perfectly false. So I can't even suggest a way of representing this in a degree semantics for gradable adjectives. Take a relative adjective like tall, people, it is represented like the set of objects for which a certain degree or measure function assigns a degree, and when that degree exceeds a threshold, a contextually variable threshold in this case, tall can be meaningfully assigned to the object. But we want to say that something is tall or true to some extent or to all extent. One trick is just to introduce a set of admissible degrees. To say that A is P to some extent would mean that given this convex set of admissible degrees, the measure of the object exceeds some degree in the interval. If you mean that it's P all extent, it means that it exceeds all degrees in this interval. So you find this universal existential structure. And take a borderline truth involving a relative adjective, like John is a borderline case of a tall person. John is, you can say things like John is tall and not tall, which arguably could mean John is tall compared to this, but not tall compared to that. So now if you think that the range of admissible comparison points is this range, well, 34 is true precisely when there is a degree such that, you know, John's height exceeds the degree. It's the second conjunct is true if it's not the case that all degrees in the interval are exceeded, are surpassed. So we can define the same way as strict tolerant degree semantics, which would say now instead of having these similarity relations, I just given a gradable adjective, I'm going to define tolerant true for the existence of a threshold in this interval, and when the measure function for the adjective assigns the object a degree exceeding the threshold, the sentence is tolerantly true, and you just universally quantify for the strict notion of truth. Now, I won't go through all the clauses, but for instance, we talked about conjunction, tolerant and strict truth distribute over conjunctions. For negation, things are more subtle because you need to interdefine the notions. I can come back to that in the discussion. But now let's go to true. Let true denote this property. It applies to objects that are sentences, and something is true if the degree assigned to the sentence exceeds a threshold. But now you will want to constrain the admissible thresholds for truth such that the admissible set should be always relative to the maximum degree in the case of that scale. So you want to have a set of degrees which is at least linearly ordered with a bottom and top element and something in between, but it could be the continuum many degrees if you'd like. And we have to assume, that's the constraint I was mentioning, that for instance the set of admissible degrees definitely excludes the minimum degree So if you're strictly true, then you're true to an extent that is higher than all these degrees, and so you have to be maximally true. You have to take the value maximum on that scale, but you could be, in order to be tolerantly true, you just need to be not false. Of course, you could introduce more options. So, as you see there, there's a number of loose ends and disconnected aspects in these thoughts, but let me try to summarize and tell you where I'm getting at. So, I propose to distinguish two kinds of partial truth. The kinds that I've called extensive are really the ones that I think best fit the account that Steve Yablo proposes in his book. To me, the sentences of that kind suppose some degree of syntactic complexity in the sentence. So you would have words like and, or never, or always. But if you take a sentence for which those markers are not there, I think there remains a legitimate notion of partial truth. So in the atomic cases I was discussing, so these sentences still admit a multiplicity of interpretations. Now, what drives these interpretations in the lexicon? Well, different kinds of words, mostly non-logical words, like sister in my example, or blue, or sexual in the Clinton case, and so on and so forth. So this brings me to the question I was raising, and there the question was the reduction. Can we reduce the intensive notion of partial truth to the extensive notion? There's a number of analogies. You see that the notion of partial truth as defined by Yablo uses this existential quantification of our parts. And the intensive notion uses the existential quantification over precisifications. And then the way I propose to sort of build a gradable notion of truth uses this existential quantification over degrees. Now, whether the intensive notion of partial truth is reducible to the extensive one, I think I'd say I'm not so sure whether it's reducible. And here is a quick argument, and I don't know what its value is. But if you take an atomic sentence with just a vague predicate, or a sentence which has this amphibolous interpretation, it does not appear to assert something like the conjunction of its various possible meanings, so that if you restrict that conjunction, you end up with the right interpretation, but more something like an open disjunction of the various possible meanings. And that's why I think that the view I was sketching initially, the one in which to be part of the content of a sentence could be being a part in this. If you thought of a disjunction in that case, to be the part of the content of a disjunctive sentence could be being just a syntactic part, is not completely forgotten on this approach. And that's it for now, and I thank you, and here are a few of the references I was mentioning. Thank you very much.